Live from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, the Total Education Show, the talk shop for teachers, parents, and administrators. Here's your host of the show, Neil Haley, the Total Tutor.
Again, I'm the host of the show, Neil Haley, and I'm really excited to be part of this project. You go to my website, TotalTutor.net, Twitter, Total Tutor, with Mary Ammons. It's going to be called Real Talk with a Real Housewife. So, Mary, thanks for calling, and I'm so excited to be doing a show with you. How are you?
Well, I'm great, Neil. Thank you so much. I am thrilled that we can do this together, and I have a whole list of really interesting people that I want to talk to and share their stories and hear what they have going on. So I'm really excited to have this inaugural show with you, Neil. Thanks for having us.
Well, I understand you have a very, very interesting guest and someone very close to you as well.
Yes, I would say that this first guest of mine, I am honored to call my hero. He is my dad, and he has taught me so much in my life about giving back and how important it is to serve the community and take care of your family and keep your priorities straight. So without further ado, Dad, I'd like to introduce you to our listening audience, Bob Schmidt. And Bob Schmidt is not only my dad, but he is the father of seven. I am the oldest of seven, and 17 and counting grandchildren, and a few what he calls rent-a-kids that he's picked up along the way that has taken in and taken care of and gotten them through school. He's also my mentor as far as my philanthropic efforts. He's taught me so much about what it means to give back to the community, like I said. And I worked for you, Dad, for a while there. He gave me an opportunity to be the executive director of the Lombardi Foundation that you started in honor of Coach Lombardi to raise money and awareness for cancer research at Georgetown Hospital at the Lombardi Center. So I just wanted to have you on the show today, Dad, because you're such an inspiration to me, and I want to honor you in that. And I also want to share with our listeners some very important projects that you have going on that that are very interesting and I think people need to hear about. So I'd say, first of all, let's talk about this this newest project that you're involved in with the NFL retired players. Can you tell us a little bit about the background?
Maybe, Mary, it would be good to kind of set the background for how this all came about.
Okay.
Approximately 7 years ago, a former football teammate of mine at the University of Southern California, Willie Wood was the first black quarterback in modern-day college football in 1957 when he played quarterback for the University of Southern California. In those days, the NFL was not so prone to look at men of color to be quarterbacks, so Willie had a stellar career with the Green Bay Packers as a defensive back and played 12 years. He's in the Pro Football Hall of Fame. And I tell the story, Willie beat me out for the quarterback job at the University of Southern California. I got even. I became his lawyer. And I say that, Jess. And then subsequently, 7 years ago, Willie started to deteriorate health-wise. And it became very evident to us that he was now suffering from early Alzheimer's dementia. So 7 years ago, I became his guardian, and until about a year ago when I turned over that responsibility to his son, we've had a very close, intimate relationship, almost for sure weekly, sometimes daily. And as a result of that, I became involved in the retired players' issues. The NFL is one of the greatest institutions in America. I mean, it has an incredible stature in our society as the game of Americans. It used to be baseball, but I think football has superseded it. And the NFL in its early days was a modest organization, but today it's a tremendous organization. It generates somewhere close to $10.5 billion annually revenue-wise. And many of these older players for whatever reasons along the way, did not share in much of that largesse. So we started putting together testimony in the Congress about some of the needs that they had. And one of the first revelations that came out in the course of those hearings was that the National Football League Players Association said they didn't represent the retired players. The NFL owners indicated they sure didn't represent them anymore. They were not active players. And as the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee said, it looks like the NFL retired players are orphans. Mm-hmm. Well, the issue moved on, and more and more people became aware of some of the needs of the players. And about 2009, we put forth the issue of concussions. And as you know, that issue has become a huge issue, not only in professional sports, but all the way down to peewee level sports, and not just men, but young women who are playing soccer and other sports have also had now to deal with the issue of concussions. But all that leading up to March 18th of this year, there had been a lawsuit filed on behalf of the retired NFL players over their image and likeness, going back to the 50s and 60s, and even, you know, on forward. The NFL has recorded and kept in very detailed archives the games that were played by the players, and many innovations have developed, such as EA Sports and others, so they've created the image and likeness of these players in very attractive electronic games. Unfortunately, the players weren't remunerated for that. So this lawsuit was brought to a head, and a settlement was proposed on March 18th by the commissioner of the NFL, Roger Goodell. And as an aftermath of that, a new organization has been created. And for the time being, until the settlement is finalized in September, it's known as the Pro Football Retired Players Association. This will be the first organization that will represent all retired players. And a retired player is defined as any person who was on a roster from 2 years ago. So the number of retired players has mushroomed from those that were considered the old Warriors, the pre-93 players, to include everybody going back to 2 years ago when the lawsuit was filed. So the number is somewhere in the neighborhood of 25 to 26,000 retired players. So this is a major breakthrough, and I think to the NFL's credit, the commissioner's credit, and the owners, I think they're finally recognizing the value that these players brought and the creation of this tremendous asset and brand called NFL football.
Well, and, Dad, what is your role going to be with the issue? Taken an active role.
For the time being, I'm serving as the executive director of the organization.
Okay. Now, question, Bob. I guess the whole thinking is that they're not taking care of the retired players. There was a conversation I've had on many retired NFL players in the 70s and 80s that really didn't make the money that today's players are making. And when you talk about the different things like EA Sports and all these different places where they're using their likeness and not being compensated, what do you think Roger Goodell's interested in doing this, but what is your thought when we talk about the NFL owners? Do you think they want to share the wealth? What is your thinking on this?
I think based on conversations I had with several owners in Phoenix when the announcement was made at the owners' meeting, I think there is a genuine interest now on the part of many owners. I didn't talk to all the owners, but the owners I spoke with indicated they really felt the need and the timing of this issue, and they wanted to step forward and do something positive about it.
Well, I hope that they do, and I remember talking to Tom Matty, was on my show, and he's doing something to raise money for retired players. So there are a lot of former players that are like, we have to help people, especially with the injuries and all these different things, Mary. And that's the terrible thing to look at, is a lot of these players put their hearts and souls into this and didn't make the money, and they, you know, want to be able to be compensated for certain things, Mary, especially when they put their lives on the line.
That's right. And there are so many stories that I've heard just in my dad bringing this issue to light. You know, there's some guys that are homeless that are, you know, these guys are like ex-war veterans. They put their bodies on the line for a lot of years, and they weren't really taken care of properly. And so I think it's a big responsibility for the whole organization to take care of those people that you know made such an impact in the sport.
Mary, you referenced Tom Maddie. Tom Maddie is a great human being. Tom Maddie and I played together when he was playing for Ohio State. I was playing for the University of Southern California. He's part of a group in Baltimore called Fourth and Goal. And Bruce Laird, another retired player, has been spearheading this, and they have. They've done a lot of good things for players. But candidly, what it was like a little Dutch boy putting his finger in the dike. There was another great Baltimore Colt named John Mackey, and John Mackey's wife is really an incredible human being. She stepped up when the previous commissioner was in power, and she met with Commissioner Tagliabue and convinced him that this issue of Alzheimer's and dementia was largely attributed to the impact of the players had on the field of combat in football. So they created a thing called the Mackey Fund. And if it hadn't been for the Mackey Fund, Willie Wood probably would have been destitute on the streets of Washington. And the Mackey Fund has stepped up and done a lot of things for those players with Alzheimer's and dementia.
Is that a nonprofit she started?
Well, I'm not sure what she actually put in place, Mary, but Sylvia Mackey is just an incredible person who's done so much. And she was a former airline cabin crew member, and she just took up her husband's cause. And in his late years, I mean, he was the former president of the National Football Players Association, and she just, you know, took John everywhere. And it was classic to see this fabulous ball player suddenly, you know, in a state of, you know, inability to comprehend what was going on around him. But it brought all the issue forward, and as a result, this whole program called the 88 Fund, it's named after his number. That was his number when he played for the Colts. And it's done a lot of good, and again, I give credit back to the NFL for recognizing that.
Absolutely.
So this new fund that's going to be created is going to benefit all retired players, no matter how old they are. Is that true?
Well, here, let me try to help you understand what the settlement is. The settlement was to create two things. One, a common good fund, and the common good fund is basically to look at all the issues that the retired players have, heavily focused on medical and health. But education, some of the retired players want to get, you know, continued education to improve their standing as a breadwinner outside of pro football. The other side of the settlement was creating an agency to represent, for commercial purposes, all of the retired players, so that their image and likeness now can be converted into monetization for these players. And this is a very important step. This will be the first time that the NFL has partnered with the retired players to promote their image and likeness, and the NFL will no longer have that capacity for third-party promotion, so that any promotion of products and services, now the players will have the ability to be self-supporting, another major step that has, you know, long been overdue. So if you look at the two, the agency will support the Common Good Fund and increase the amount of funds that are in there. The original amount is $42 million. It'll be paid out over an eight-year period. But the idea is that we can grow the fund exponentially by the use of the agency.
Wow, Bob. I guess when we get back, I want to go more into how we make sure that all this gets implemented. Because we all know, especially when so many people have their hand in the cookie jar involving merchandising and involving all these things, to make sure that these players get paid. Because now you're looking at so many people, so many players. So you're listening to Real Talk with the Real Housewife with Mary Amons and myself, the co-host Neil Haley, the Total Tutor. And we'll be back in just a moment. We're back to Real Talk with a Real Housewife, and that's Mary Ammons and myself, the co-host Neil Haley, the Total Tutor, who enjoys doing the co-hosting of Mary interesting things, and we're talking to Bob Schmidt, and I'm just quite interested in this whole situation with the $47 million payout to the NFL retired players. And Bob, now, once this happens, it doesn't guarantee it's all going to happen, right? I mean, once the money is supposed to be divvied up and how they make sure from now on their image and likeness is going to be theirs to manage, who's going to kind of look out for everything to make sure it happens?
Well, here, first of all, the first thing we did was we created a board of directors. And the board of directors is initially seven people. And the seven people include several Hall of Fame members. For example, the chairman is Jim Brown, the famous Cleveland Brown, who's really the Babe Ruth of professional football. The vice chairman is Ron Mix, another member of the Hall of Fame. The secretary treasurer is Billy Joe Dupree, another member. The other members include Dave Robinson, the former Green Bay Packer, who will be going in the Hall of Fame this year. Jack Youngblood, another Hall of Famer from the Rams. And Darrell Thompson and Irv Cross. So it's basically going to be retired players who will determine the distribution and how the whole operation will work in terms of both the Common Good Fund and the Agency Fund. The Common Good Fund will be a 501c3 charitable fund, so the public, fans, and others can contribute to that as well. The Agency Fund, again, will be a for-profit, and the way it'll work is that the individual opportunities that are created, whether they're group licensing or individual licensing, 75% proceeds will go to the individuals who participate in that particular commercial endeavor. An image that none of them were very satisfied with. You know, many of these men have got still such pride, they wouldn't go and ask for a favor, and they'd rather suffer through their dilemmas. And I think that the critical issue that most of these players have relate to health and medical benefits. So that's going to be the major focus of what we're trying to accomplish for the retired players. Now, granted, there's a spread from the very old players, who we call the pre-93 players, and the post-93 players. So their interests are varied, but at the same time, there'll be programs designed to try to appeal to the different age groups among the retired players. And the membership will be deciding, you know, this board was originally appointed by the court, but then the membership will be making these decisions. So it's, again, I think a major breakthrough where the individual players will determine their own fate instead of having to go to the NFL for handouts and begging for support.
Absolutely, and I think that the big key component is for Bob, for the players that put their lives on the line, to be able to have life after football, be able to have a pension, a retirement in some sort of way, getting money so they don't constantly, especially when their health is going to go, they're going to suffer lots more health problems in their lives for putting those years into the NFL. They're going to not be able to do all the types of jobs that other people would be able to do at age 50, and that they have to have that compensation. So that's a key component to make sure that they can continue to live productive lives.
Also, there's an issue with the older guys, too, that, you know, the equipment was not even near the same. So their injuries are far greater than those that are just coming out of retirement now.
It's a complicated process, folks, but at the same time, you know, we don't want to see football stop. What we want to see is it becomes more safe, that the whole sort of concern about the health and welfare of the players is more focused. And, you know, there's been an image, like it or not, that these players, once they're finished, they were discarded and thrown away. And that has to change. And I think that there is, again, this recognition on the part of the NFL that these people were really human beings and not just part of the show, that they just kind of made sure that the tickets were sold.
That's right. Neil, I'm thinking of our recent trip to Pittsburgh, my recent trip to Pittsburgh, and we were talking to Rocky Blyer, who's that famous Steeler, who's such a great guy, and he was telling us stories about how, and also Tom Mack, they were telling us stories about how, you know, when you were down on the field, you got back up, no matter if you had your bell rung or not. You just did not quit. And he said he knows many times he had some kind of concussion, and he just got up and continued in the game because that was the way it was done then.
I think we were all taught as players, and again, the system promoted the idea of the macho man, you know, and they said, you know, you're not hurt, you can play, get up and get in there.
Yeah.
And then there's this allegiance you build towards your teammates. You don't let your teammates down. So it's a combination of things that, you know, plays on the psychic, and probably there were many instances when players should have stepped out instead of going back in, but that was not easy for them to do because of their sense of pride.
I think so, and I think also, I guess, that they didn't know how bad concussions were at that time, Bob. They didn't know that
Correct.
They could be to the point of certain illnesses occur, certain situations, really not being able, and then look at the situations with Mike Webster and many other NFL players that just went to just lost dementia, all these different things that they have to figure out a way of protecting them, and I guess financially protecting them as well, Bob.
Well, again, I think the good news is that this is a big step forward. But as you might expect, there's still people within the group who don't understand the magnitude of it. There's a certain percentage, hopefully a minority, that think that this is not enough, that the NFL ought to do more. And again, when you have a group as prideful as this, there's some players who feel that the league has abandoned them over the years, and this is just another fake-out. But hopefully we'll overcome those kind of skeptics and make this a reality for all of them.
Well, absolutely.
Yes, wonderful. Well, thank you, Dad. I am extremely proud to call you my dad, and you've taught me so much about what it means to give back, and you're definitely giving back in serving in this capacity on behalf of the retired players, and I'm very proud of you for that. And anything else, Neil?
Yeah, I got a couple more questions. We're running out of time. But, Bob, what do you think is your ultimate goal of being involved in this? Again, with your great work with the Lombardi Foundation and what you've done and how you've helped retired players in certain ways and really staying around and understanding what's going on, what's the ultimate goal that you want with this?
Well, Neil, let me put it in perspective. I'm a very blessed human being. My father was an immigrant from Germany. I was the first son to go to the university. If it hadn't been for football, I probably wouldn't have the education that I received as a lawyer, businessman. And I learned as a young man, giving back is essential to your whole well-being. It not only makes you feel good, it's like a multiplier. When you give, more people want to give, and I give great credit to people like Bill Gates now that are causing a lot of folks with buckets of money to recognize. There are no suitcases when you leave this earth. So, if you don't start to recognize you can do a lot of good and put back in, it's a great feeling of self-worth. And I've been very blessed in that regard.
Well, absolutely. And I really appreciate you coming on the show. And, Bob, where can we find information on what's going on currently with the – do you have a website for people to find?
You can go to our website, which is ProFootballRetiredPlayersAssociation.com.
Well, I appreciate you calling, Bob, and keep us informed of what's going on with this, and we'll try to have some – we'll ask and kind of get the word out to certain –
appreciate the opportunity to speak about it. Thank
All right.
you.
All right. Thanks a lot, Bob. And Mary, I
thank
guess,
you, Dad.
Okay, so Mary, I guess we're going to sign off. Again, good talking to you, and we'll talk soon. And go ahead and sign us off, Mary.
Well, thank you for listening. This is Real Talk with a Real Housewife. I'm Mary Amon, and thank you, Neil, for having me on the Total Education Network and the Total Tutor. And tune in next week when we have some more fun guests.
Back to Total Education Celebrity Show on the Total Education Network, TotalTutor.net for more information. And my guest who brings on the most interesting rap artists in the world, I've not talked in a couple months, so I want to first want to welcome the program, Sean XLG. Sean, how are you, man?
Doing good, Neil. Doing good, man. It's been a minute, but we're back on track, and we got a special guest today. My man Dana Dane with Fame will be joining us today.
All right. Well, fantastic, Dana. Thanks for calling, man.
Thanks for having me on the show. Greatly appreciate it. Much love to talk to my man, Sean XLG, once again on the Full Circle. So, yes, let's do it.
All right, fantastic, Sean. Kind of tell us a little bit of background about Dana, and then we'll get to some questions.
Okay. Well, Dana Dane, of course, one of the Brooklyn bred MCs coming out of New York City, started out as a member of the Kango crew, used to be a partner with Slick Rick, with Deggy Fresh, Slick Rick fame. So they started out as the Kango crew, and of course, everybody eventually went their separate ways and scored huge success with the debut album, Dana Dane with Fame, which actually peaked at number 46. On the Billboard album chart and was certified gold. Dana Dane is the second solo MC to actually have a gold LP. So, and then, of course, he followed that up with Cinderfella Dana Dane, which peaked at number 11 on the charts. And this was back in 1987. So Dana Dane with Fame is joining us today as our special guest, and let's bring him on board.
Okay, Dana, let me ask a question. First of all, how you broke in the business. Tell me a little bit of how that happened.
Yeah, and I appreciate that, Sean XLG. But, you know, just to clarify, on the album charts, I was number two. The album went number two. Couldn't get that number one spot because Michael Jackson's Bad was on there. So, you know, what can I say about that? But with that said, yeah, I broke into the music business after hearing the you know, y'all remember that classic cassette tape with Lottie Dottie and the show on that went around as a mixtape back in the day before it went on sale. And after hearing that and then them putting out the show as a single and all the success they got from that song, I was like, I could do that. I know Rick. We was in a group together. I can rap. So, you know, a friend of mine had been asking me, his name was Sam Jacobs Jr. He's known as MC Holiday, also a.k.a. the Gucci Man, who's since passed since then. He had leukemia. He was the producer on my first single, Nightmares. He'd been asking me, you know, to come in and do a song, but I was like, nah, I'm not into that. I'm in college and things. But when I heard Rick's song with Dougie Fresh, I thought, I bet. I gave him a call. We went and started working in the lab, and, you know, we sent out the single, Nightmares, the cassette, to, like, various record labels from the top to the bottom. And Profile Records, Gary Peeney, he heard the song out of the box of cassettes and said, yo, let's talk to this guy, and they brought me in. And it's funny that when Nightmares came out in 1985, and it was a hit, a big success, early 1996, January, February, March, April, May, I'm getting letters from record labels still saying, nope, we'll pass. This is not the type of song we're looking for. It's not a hit, you know. It's not, you know, it, you know, I'm still getting, you know, just letters of decline, but the song is already on the charts and on its way up. So that was kind of funny to me.
And Sean, kind of give us the picture as the historian of this when he did finally break in. Give us specifics from what your history of knowing about Dana.
Yeah, I would say around that time when Dougie Fresh and Slick Rick came out, I think the art of storytelling within hip-hop became real popular at that time. And of course, we're talking about the early 1985 into 1986 and into 87. So storytelling wasn't original at that point because, of course, you had artists like Grandmaster Caz, who was telling stories about Yvette, and some of the other artists that were out, Jimmy Spicer and Cool Out. Those brothers were telling
Rather
stories. Delight,
they did a little bit of it too, as well. You know,
exactly. Yeah. So by '85, when the show came out, Lottie Dottie, you know, that really hit hard, and of course, that single went gold. So storytelling became a whole nother avenue for artists to get into. And, of course, Dana Dane was one of the top artists in the history of hip-hop to ever get into storytelling. So when Nightmares came out, that was like a hit all over, from the radio to the streets, on the blocks. Everybody was listening to Nightmares when Dana Dane hit with that one. So that actually, Dana Dane and Slick Rick became like the top two storytellers, basically, in hip-hop. And so that started a whole trend where all other MCs were jumping on the bandwagon. But the best, in my opinion, to ever done it was Dana Dane and Slick Rick. You know, those are my top two MCs in terms of storytelling. And, of course, Eminem gets into it, and Biggie was an excellent storyteller as well. But as far as understanding the music, the songwriting aspects of it, from intro to body to conclusion, I would say Slick Rick and definitely my man Dana Dane were the top two to ever do it.
So, Dana, I guess, how did you become such a good writer? What would you think gave you that ability? Do you think it's just basically wanting to tell from the heart what your life was about?
You know what? When I always tell people this, because, you know, I get this battle between, you know, those who call themselves hip-hop historians and, you know, old school and classic, and they're like, yeah, you know, Dana Dane bit off Slick Rick, Slick Rick bit off Dana Dane, and I always set the story straight. When I met Rick, he was already ready telling story raps. You know, he had this joint about poker, and he was like, you got to know when to hold them, fold them type of story about playing poker, which was incredible. And from there, and that was early, late 1979 going to 80, that I was like, yo, and I was just really just mimicking other rappers, like the hip, the hop, the hip, no real structure to my rap or at all, you know. And when I met him, I like that. That's what I need to be doing right there, because that's hot. So I went home literally after that day and started writing one line at a time, just trying to figure out how to bring my story to life. And, you know, that's I basically found out I had a talent for it. And, you know, I can't say that it was something that I guess it is something that I learned, but it felt like it was second nature to me. And then when I graduated out of high school and I went to college, I went there for accounting. I went to college for accounting, which was a bad mistake, because when I got there, my favorite class was creative writing. And I really started getting into that and just writing stories, not rhymes, just stories from beginning to end. And they taught me about anecdotes and how you outline things, and you write down your intro and your body and conclusion and how you bring that all together. And from there, that's when I think I really started to excel as a writer and telling story rhymes. So that, I guess that's basically where I really picked up and honed my skills at, is in college, even though I never got a degree.
Well, what it sounds like to me, Dana, is that you, again, were a person that wanted to educate yourself. You saw, again, writing as a tool to talk about your life. And Sean, what would you say he's best known for? What would you say Dana Dane's best known for, our audience that might have not, you know, been into rap at that time? What would you say Dane is best known for?
Oh, I would definitely have to say the storytelling part with the Dana Dane with Fame, you know, Cinderfella probably is one of his biggest hits, Cinderfella, Dana Dane. And one of the stories that Dana told me before a couple of years ago was how he went on tour with Houdini and actually wrote the majority of his album while he was on tour with Houdini. And of course, he and I both kind of learned a lot of our writing skills from Jahlil of Houdini, who, in my opinion, is one of the greatest songwriters in hip-hop history.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. I second that emotion.
Yeah. So Jahlil was, you know, he was an incredible writer. You know, I told Jahlil myself that I think he's the greatest of all time in terms of songwriting and hip hop. So, you know, it's one of those things that, you know, of course,
course, you know, Dana Dane, you know, was looking at Houdini the same way I was and thousands of other MCs out there who were really influenced by songs like Friends and Freaks Come Out at Night, Haunted House of Rock. You know, so writing for me actually developed from learning from Houdini. And I think, you know, Dana being on tour with Houdini at that time period, because Houdini and Run DMC and the Fat Boys were basically the three biggest rap acts in hip hop during the mid-80s, and of course the Beastie Boys were big as well. Mm-hmm. So Dana Dane being on tour, you know, with Houdini was a big thing.
So Dana, how did you kind of get used to the fame? Like when you were on top in your game and people, you had lots of fans. How did you handle it, especially from, you know, someone who went to college, who saw specifically, you know, was looking, I guess, towards in your career being an accountant? You never thought, you know, that you'd be at this on this large of a stage. How did you handle the fame?
I just seen it as being, and I guess I contributed to my mom's and just being raised in Fort Greene Projects with them, and then going to music and art and having the opportunity to see different cultures once I got to music and art. And I guess when I got to the height of my fame from my record, it seemed like second nature to me because I was famous in high school from being in the Kango crew. And every day that was our thing, you know, to dress up me, Flip Rick, Lance Brown, Kool Aid Ski, Omega the Heartbreaker, the five members of the Kango crew. And we were, you know, we had memberships for the Kango crew, and, you know, everybody would come to the lunchroom to see us rap, and, you know, we were the talk of the school, and other people knew us from that school. And you know, when it came to breaking into the music business and getting the fame, I just always remember to treat people how that you would want to be treated, no matter who you were or where you were or what status you had. And that really went a long way for me to stay grounded. And, you know, not let the fame really overtake who I was personally. So I contributed that to, you know, a few things.
And, Sean, you can kind of tell us the history of where Dana reached his peak and then went the wayside like everyone else. They have their top notch being on the top and then finally moving to a new type of scene as we see in rap, how it changes throughout. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, hip hop changes very quickly and drastically. I think Dana Dane from 1985 to probably 1989, 1990, Dana Dane was one of the hottest MCs out there making music. And then, of course, around 1990, that we had the rise of the West Coast coming into play, where you had Ice Cube, N.W.A., Dr. Dre. So you had a rise. There was a paradigm shift around 1990 with the West Coast coming alive and really making a dent in the music industry, especially on the street level, where you had what was called gangster rap, giving birth to that style of hip hop, and that became what pretty much the most dominant force in hip hop music at that time, from around 90 all the way up and through the late 90s. So you kind of had an imbalance in terms of hip hop, what kids were listening to, and you know, and the focus, the whole entire focus became on the West Coast. You know, where you saw Snoop Dogg and a lot of the Dog Pound and a lot of those artists that came out, Warren G and those guys came out and really made a lot of noise. And at the same time when that happened, of course you had artists like Dana Dane, Kumo D, and some of the East Coast artists that were hot at that time. You know, some of their popularity began to wane at that period.
Okay, well, fantastic. Dana, it was great having you on the show. Look forward to having you back in a couple months. But where can our listeners find out more information on you and learn more about you?
I'm building my multimedia production company right now. We've switched over to music to film production. I've written a book called Numbers as well, a fiction. And now I've turned my writing skills over not just to raps, but to, screenplays and TV series and things of that sort. So right now I'm building all of those foundations to really break into the media industry over the next couple of years. I've produced a couple of independent projects, so looking forward to doing a feature film in the near future. But they can catch me up on deftent.com. That's my website for my multimedia production company, deftent.com. Or they can hit me up at danadane.com, danadane.com. That's my personal website. You know, my mom told me if you want people to remember, you sing it to them, danadane.com.
Well,
and all the Twitter and Instagram and Facebook and YouTube is Dana Dane Media. Y'all can find me Dana Dane Media.
I'm gonna tweet you out today, Dana. After all my marathon of interviews before I go on vacation, I went and loaded myself up the next 2 weeks, but everything did work out. Glad to have you on the show, and appreciate you calling, man.
Thank you very much, man. I greatly appreciate you all, and blessing and love. You ever need me, you know where to get me at, and look forward to joining you all again, all right?
All right, Sean, where can we find information on you, by the way, man?
You can look me up at SeanXLG.com. I'm also having my book, Hip Hop Parade, Celebrating 30 Years of Rap Music, available on Amazon.com, Barnes & Noble. It's also available on Books A Million, all the online bookstores. And I'm also looking forward to trying to get some music projects and a couple other books I'm working on with Kool Rock coming out this year. We're going to talk about the 50 greatest hip hop acts of all time. So that book is going to be up and coming, and so it's going to cause a little bit of controversy, but it is what it is.
All right, guys, thanks for calling the program, and Sean, I look forward to our next guest on the show, and I think we'll be able to kind of get things together for me on that, and look forward to talking to you soon, and thanks for calling, Dana.
All right, thank you.
All right, take care. All right, you're listening to Total Education Celebrity Show, and we'll be back in just a moment. We're back to Total Education Spotlight Show on the Total Education Network, TotalTutor.net for more information. Twitter, Total Tutor, Neil S. Haley, Facebook, and I want to welcome the program, Tish Saravola. Tish, thanks for calling.
Oh, thank you for having me today.
Well, I've been having a lot of Grammy Award winners and nominated and Grammy Award nominees, and I've learned a lot about specifically how they made it. But Tish, you help these people make it, right? You're part of the process, correct?
Well, yeah, I mean, I am president and founder of Daisy Rock Girl Guitars. And really, that's where it starts with music, is learning how to play an instrument. And so at Daisy Rock, we're doing everything we can to help support any girl that wants to learn how to play a guitar and write music. And, you know, the end result with that is that they end up winning a Grammy for their artistic endeavors. We handle a lot of artists like Lisa Loeb, for instance, is one of the artists that we work with that's been a Grammy-nominated artist. And, of course, we have Wanda Jackson, who's been inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. But any girl that plays guitar, Daisy Rock Girl Guitars, is somehow connected with or working with or wanting to help on their process of being an artistic individual that can actually get nominated for a Grammy down the road.
Well, fantastic, Tish. So basically what you do is you're creating the artists in certain ways, helping them develop their skills in different ways. How do you do that? Tell me how that works.
Well, here at Daisy Rock, our mission statement is we're doing whatever it takes to get more girls to learn how to play guitar and enjoy reading and writing music. So I think how we do that on a level of from a guitar manufacturer is that we're supporting any girl at whatever level she's at. In other words, we're not a record company that says, hey, you only play 3 chords, you're not good enough, right? We're the guitar company that says, hey, you're a girl and you play 3 chords, that's awesome. How can we help you progress and how can we help you develop more as an artist? We're the only guitar company really out there that does that. First of all, we're the only girl guitar company in existence. And then secondly, really, we're the only girl guitar company out there that is helping girls learn this thing called guitar and then go out and play music live and play guitar live and write these awesome songs that are then, you know, looked at by the Grammys.
Would you say the message, Tish, is a very important part of this process, that basically to be able to be that advocate for women to go out there and do this is a key component of the organization? It sounds like it to me.
I think you said it so much more eloquently than I just did. But, yeah, you know, where I am standing up for every girl out there that plays guitar. And I got to tell you, I don't think to win a Grammy you have to be a prodigy or you have to be an exceptional, you know, the exception to the rule. I think you have to come from a passion of wanting to be voiced in music. And I think that that can come from knowing three chords or knowing every single chord that's out there. I think it's a passion and it's an expression too. So, like I said, we're the only company out there that's really supporting any girls that really want to do this for, you know, for what they love and what they're into. And my biggest moment ever in life would be to have a girl on stage getting a Grammy saying, I only play guitar because Daisy Rock Girl Guitar has made a guitar out there that I could play on. And that they've taken that to the next level and got to that point in their life where they could actually get nominated and win a Grammy because they play Daisy Rock.
So let's talk about your brand, your guitar. What makes your guitar different than others for women that are considering that type of a guitar? What makes it so special?
Well, Daisy Rock Girl Guitars, there's never been a girl guitar before I designed one. A girl guitar is defined by having a slimmer neck profile, so the neck is actually slightly smaller than a normal guitar is, and then it's lighter in weight, so it's not so heavy. I played in a lot of bands in the 80s in Los Angeles, and I was in a heavy metal band called Lipstick, and the problem with the basses that I tried to learn how to play is they all felt like baseball bats, and they were really tough for me to learn how to play on. And I took that experience with me when my daughter one day did a drawing of a daisy, and I put a neck and a headstock in the shape of a leaf on it, and I took it to my husband, who's president of Schecter Guitars. And I said, you know what we should do? We should make guitars for girls, because that way, if we got more girls to learn how to play guitar, then what better world would it be to have more girls playing guitar and more girls out there in the music scene? And it would kind of like level the playing field, so to speak.
Well, I'm fascinated by this, and especially I have three girls of my own, and I've not got them into guitars yet. My youngest is 8. What age do you think that they should start playing a guitar? What's your recommendation?
I like that 6 to 8 years of age, because I think that imagination is still so much a part of a kid's life at that age. And that, you know, you get a girl with a guitar that's jumping up and down on her bed in a feather boa acting like a rock star, and we all win. You know, from that scenario, this is you bringing that into the world with a girl going, I could totally play guitar, instead of, you know, saying, well, maybe I could play piano or maybe I could play violin. Not that anything is wrong with those scenarios, but the fact that she could play guitar today in the world in 2013, it's more common to see a girl playing a guitar than it has ever been. So that is the whole idea behind what I do, is let's change society's idea about a girl playing guitar. It used to be, she's from the wrong side of the tracks, or she must come from a divorced family, or, you know, let's have the cheerleaders and, you know, the booster club girls play guitar and go out and just, like, kick some butt that way.
Well, and that's definitely so true. And so if you're saying a young age, it's something where when you expose them to this, you say, why guitar? Again, this is your brand, and you again played in a band. Why guitar? What's so special about the guitar?
Well, you have to ask yourself, what is it that you feel when you see somebody like Jewel sing and play a guitar? Or there's a sense of empowerment for other girls. When girls see other girls playing guitar, they get that sense that I can do that too. It's like with seeing a girl that can surf, or seeing a girl that's typically doing something that boys have only done before. It empowers a girl to think, you know what, there should be no barrier between male and female. I should be able to do that too, just as well, if not better than a boy can. So that's why I look at girls playing guitar, is I want girls to look at it and think, yeah, I can do that.
Absolutely. And they can do it. And what is your hope? Do you hope that there's going to be a lot more girl bands coming out and different things with the guitars if we continue to see these changes?
I don't think there could be anything worse in life. I think that it would be, this is the most wonderful world we could live in, is to have more girls playing guitar and have more girl bands out there and have it be every time you see a guy in a band, you see a girl in a band. That would be like the most awesome thing ever.
Well, absolutely. Let's go to Lisa Loeb because she is going to be coming on my show. I think we're trying to still coordinate schedules before, as you heard me say, when I'm on vacation. But tell me how you support Lisa in her quest and especially being a Grammy-nominated guitarist.
Well, you know, Lisa has always had this wonderful indie reputation, right? And so Lisa found me at the NAMM show when she saw my booth, and she said, oh, my gosh, pink guitars. No one's ever done this before. And she was really impressed with the fact that Daisy Rock had finally designed something for a girl that would be smaller, a petite girl. And Lisa was very petite. So she immediately keyed in on the fact that we had something that fit her physically better. But then she started playing the guitar saying, hey, you know, these are as good, if not better, than other guitars out there. And we knew that from Daisy Rock. We knew that as soon as we came out with something, it had to totally kick the butt of every guy guitar out there. So it would be taken seriously, you know what I'm saying?
Absolutely.
So Lisa keyed in on that right away. She's been a big supporter of my company since I started. She loves pink. You know, she's a pink girl. There's not every girl is a pink girl, but she's definitely a pink girl. And I think she loves the fact that there's something feminine in the guitar world out there now, something that says femininity to a girl really speaks strongly to Lisa.
The pink guitar, that's another good part of your brand. I tell you,
because
girls are going to like, especially the younger age, you're going to want to pick up something that looks pretty, looks understandable.
Yeah.
A lot of times you see guitars that are very heavy and difficult to maneuver in certain ways, and you make something really attractive looking, you'll see more girls at young age having, models of your guitar before they come out as real guitars, right? That should be a thought of you, to go ahead to have these children's guitars.
We do. Of course we do that. You know, we do the guitars in the shapes of stars and butterflies and hearts and ladybugs. And there's a reason why we do that. And that's to get the younger girls to look at it and go, oh, it's a guitar. I could totally play that. You know, that's the whole concept behind it, is that there shouldn't be a division between girls shouldn't be able to play guitar. That's the whole idea to change what Daisy Rock's mission is. We're doing whatever it takes to get more girls to learn how to play guitar, because it should have been that way 40 years ago. And it all started, you know?
Exactly. Where do you see the company? Where do you want the company to be in the next 5 years?
That's a funny question. If you ask me, I have a one answer. My bank has a totally different answer. Because we're a business. We want to grow. Of course, we want to be more profitable and sell more guitars, because that's really how you stay in business. But my idea is that every time you turn on a TV show or every time you see a movie, the more times you see a girl playing a guitar, the more times the world changes and the world becomes a better place. And that's really where I want to see us in 5 years. I want it to be so normal that it's over normal, if you know what I mean.
So ultimately awareness, to bring awareness in certain ways. And by coming on this show and telling people, and then maybe finding a lot of women singers and get them involved in playing a guitar, saying, you know what you can bring to the table and how you'll differentiate yourself, especially if you're in a band right now, learn how to play guitar. Is it never too late to learn?
It's never too late. We're the number one guitar for the grandmother's club. You know, we're the number one guitar for the preschoolers. It's, you know, it's never too early or too late. You just do it and have fun with it. This is why we have Daisy Rock, and that's to bring fun and joy in the world.
Oh, do you have any events coming up to promote your stuff or anything going on right now promoting the
We'll be at Summer NAMM. I don't know if you know about Summer NAMM, but we'll be there the second week of July in Nashville. And we do the NAMM show. It's a big event for us. The big one in Anaheim in January is our huge event. We always have artists that come and play. And I received an award last NAMM, a Woman Who Rocks Award. A She Rocks Award is what they called it. It's an honor. And we, of course, are involved with anytime there's anything with a girl in guitar, Daisy Rock wants to be right there. You know, be part of it. So But our big event, probably the soonest I can think of off the top of my head, is the NAMM show coming up.
Okay, Tish, where can we find more information on you and purchase your guitar and learn more about you?
You know, that's a very simple answer. It's daisyrock.com, daisyrock.com. And everything's right there on where you can find our guitars for sale. From, you know, we have DRTV, which I support all of our artists, so you can go on there and check out all of the different videos of our artists, and that'll also shoot you to our Facebook page. We have a lot of stuff going on our Facebook. We're always doing giveaways and contests. We want to be part of anything. Anybody out there has any ideas, shoot me an email. And I'm right there on daisyrock.com.
Well, Tish, thanks for calling the program, and best of luck to you.
Oh, thank you. So nice meeting you. Thank you so much.
All right, take care now. Okay, bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
You're listening to Total Education Spotlight Show. We'll be back in just a moment.